I'm going to call the House Committee on Rules to order and let them present. The record show that there is a quorum present. And with that, we're going to open a public hearing on HJR 28. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator and Representative Harker and Senator Brzezinski. If you'd like to come up, you can.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HJR 28 proposes a constitutional amendment to require that initiative petitions proposing a law or constitutional amendment with a fiscal impact include within the proposed law or amendment or in connection with the proposed law or amendment a method for providing revenue equal to the fiscal impact.
And with that,
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thanks so much for having us here. I gather you've heard a fair bit about initiative reform lately.
My name is
Chris Harker. I'm the representative from House District 34.
Thank you.
You bet.
Sir. And, after all the times I've been on that side, I should have realized how I should behave over here. Hopefully I'll get the rest of it right. So thanks for listening to our input here. I am very happy to be here and to be part of this bicameral and bipartisan group that is putting forth this proposal, this bill. And based on everything I hear, voters like having a direct say in the government. They like the initiative process, but they feel the process is not being used as intended, and it frequently does not have the results intended. We, in this bill, are not trying to stand between the voters and the initiative process. We believe there is value to this direct pathway from the voters. We simply want to inject some fiscal responsibility into the process. As Representative Galizio has said, we want to mend, not end, the initiative process. And as Senator Morse mentioned the other day, there's been a significant impact on our financial resources from the collection of initiatives that have passed. I'd like to tell a little story that I think says what's behind this bill. I read something about Brazil the other day, and it kind of fired up my wanderlust. And then as I was driving down here this morning, I thought more and more about this. Maybe it was the rain, the dreariness, but travel started to sound really good to me. I'd never been to South America, thought I would love to do this. By the time I came down to the capital, I had pretty much talked myself into it. And then I came around the corner, and I saw Willamette University there, which gave me a great reality check. I quoted Homer Simpson, "Doh! I have to pay for college in the fall." Suddenly, Brazil didn't seem like such a good idea anymore. My son's college education seemed more important than going to Brazil right now. I think that we, the people of Oregon, when we're voting on initiatives, need that type of reality check. We think we know what we want, but what are we really willing to pay for? That's the question that we try to insert with this constitutional amendment. This bill is simply intended to provide that fiscal reality check.
Thank you very much. Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and committee members. Thank you very much for allowing me to be here today in support of House Joint Resolution 28. For the record, my name is Floyd Brzezinski, State Senator representing District 4, which includes parts of Lane and Douglas County. I'm here with Representative Hawker, who basically has brought forward an opportunity for us as the legislature to allow the voters to have another say in the initiative process. This is a process to allow for voters to be one recognizing and have the interest of knowing when they're voting on a matter that they have some interest in as to how it's going to actually get paid. I think all of us realize from our perspective of sitting as a representative or as a senator, when a citizen initiative is in fact passed, there is no guidance to us as to how that matter is supposed to be funded. No matter what you may think of the policy, there is no mechanism that's built into the initiative process at this stage that gives us any guidance of what the voters really want us to do into funding that the mechanism that we'll use for funding that initiative. So what we have to look at is what do we currently have? And as most of us know, people say, well, you have the general fund. Well, the general fund, of course, funds three major areas of state government: education, public safety and human services. And at the same time, we know that there's not an unlimited amount of money there to take on other endeavors. I'll use one example, and this is not to comment on the policy itself, but just the fiscal impact that it had. In 1994, the voters passed measures 10, 11, and 17. 10 was one that just put, required us to have a supermajority of how we would change any sentencing that was approved by the voters. There was no true cost in that measure itself to implement it. Measure 11, on the other hand, was one that set up mandatory minimum sentencing for those individuals who were, in fact, being convicted and would be convicted in the future for serious person type of offenses, specifically felonies. And then 17 was another one that actually required us to put every inmate to work some type of job within the while they were incarcerated, with very few exceptions. If you look today at the cost of what Measure 11 now is costing the state to actually, with it being fully implemented, it is overwhelming to look at how much money has now had to be shifted from other programs within the general fund to pay for that. One particular program within the public safety sector. So what JR, and my understanding is that the committee will be looking at the Dash 2 amendments, actually does do, it actually gives a perspective and allows the voters to say, yes, we agree that when we have a citizen initiative in front of us, we would like to know if it has a dollar amount of $50,000 or more per biennium, how that's going to be funded. That would actually allow us as the legislators to have some guidance. It also will give us the opportunity to hear directly from the voters as to whether or not they want to have that initiative go forward based on the funding source it has. And I want to really take a moment to recognize against Representative Parker for his efforts to put something forward that will give us some clarity. I know many of us have looked at this issue before. I've had a couple of different measures that I thought would be worthy of going forward for consideration of how things could, in fact, be required to be funded. This is just another tool that we can actually utilize. And it appears from looking at the Dash 2 amendments, legislative council has addressed the issue that I think most of us would have concern on, is whether or not we can have multiple subjects without violating the single subject rule. And it's my understanding, in speaking with a good representative, that the interpretation that legislative council has given, they said that what's in the Dash 2s will in fact meet the constitutional requirements, and that there would be in fact a nexus to the issue that would be before the voters, plus the funding source for that initiative policy.
Thank you. Questions for these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both for being here.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to be excused to go up to my other committee.
Absolutely. Thanks. Thanks for coming and making the time.
Senator Leeds, I'm sorry, I do have a question.
Yes, Representative Nolan.
I love this idea. I think this is a great idea, and I think it would help the voters make the best decision for giving us information on how they prioritize things. So I think it would increase the information we have of from the voters about where their priorities are. But I noticed that the language in both the resolution and the amendment speak to petitions that require expenditure of public monies. They don't speak to petitions that reduce general fund revenues. Was that a deliberate omission?
Shall I?
Please.
My response was that we were primarily focused on the increase, what seems to be an ever-increasing control of the expenditures that we have as a result of initiatives. Things that come in and say, you must do X, Y, or Z without allocating funds for it. I think it was more or less a deliberate decision than unconscious.
Thanks.
Senator, any thought on that one?
No, I'm reviewing the language, and I guess I'd ask Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, Specifically, are you referring to what's online? I'm looking at the Dash 2 amendment, because my understanding, that's the part that's actually going to be inserted into the resolution at the bottom of page 1.
Well, on the Dash, Mr. Chair, if I may?
Yeah.
Oh, I have a Dash 1 amendment. I'm sorry.
I have a few of these here, or we could read them to you.
Mr. Chair, I don't think any of us have a Dash 2.
I agree. We have a Dash 1.
Yeah. Mm. Sorry. Maybe I'm not referring to the most current edition.
If I may, Mr. Chair, my understanding is that in speaking with the with staff, the Dash 2s were supposed to have been referred out to you, and that is what we were told that
okay.
we were
okay.
supposed to be commenting on. So okay. I guess really when you look at the Dash 2s, when you get those on lines 3 is where it actually inserts the new language and says an initial petition that proposes a law or amendment to the Constitution that will require an expenditure of public monies by the state and that amount totaling excess of $50,000 per biennium. So my perspective on that is basically whenever you have any measure that's going to be a statutory or something that would go into the Constitution, that is going to require us as the legislature to expend monies, and I think that would in fact include the general fund monies of $50,000 or greater, that then they would need to basically be informed as to where that money is going to be coming from and how exactly where it's going to actually be what the proposed source of that money would be. And one of the biggest concerns I have is to make certain that we don't have an escape clause or a fallback to just the general fund as it stands today. And it's my understanding from speaking with Representative Harker, again with his discussions with LC, is that the terminology that's used here would in fact require a citizen initiative that's going to have that type of impact to actually list where that money's coming from.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
Thank you very much.
Right. Now we have it.
All right, thank you. Okay, thank you.
I apologize. I thought you had number 2.
Well, yeah.
Now we do?
No problem. Now we do.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. The only other person to sign up for this bill was Dan Meek.
My name is Dan Meek. I represent several public interest groups that have put measures on the ballot since 1978. First, if I may, a note on process. And this is not a criticism of this committee because it happens in every committee. And that is what is noticed for hearing is then not the substance of what is actually presented at the hearing or, you know. What happens all the time is that what's noticed for hearing, like in this case, is House Joint Resolution 21. There's only one version on the Internet. That's the introduced version. And now we find that there is a Dash 1 amendments that aren't available until, you know, 5 seconds before the hearing. And now even a Dash 2 amendments, it's still not available to anyone. Except now members of the committee actually during the hearing. So I think it really makes a mockery of the hearing process when the subject matter of the hearing is supposed to be one thing, when in fact, by the time you get here, it's changed to something that I don't even know what it is now. So my comments are about the
original
version that's on the Internet, and I think you need to have some sort of a rule that if you're going to have a hearing on something, whether if there are amendments out there and that's what the hearing is about, then they should be posted on the Internet at least, well, I don't know, 48 hours in advance, at least give people some chance to know what the actual hearing is going to be about. House Joint Resolution 28 itself is dramatically overbroad and completely unworkable. First of all, it applies to any measure that will require the expenditure of public monies by the state. Well, that's every measure, essentially. It applies even if the measure on balance saves money. Because even if the measure saves money, it almost certainly requires some expenditure of public funds, because I can't think of a measure that wouldn't require the expenditure of some public funds. So this is going to apply to every single measure, and not just every measure, every prospective petition. And here's why it's unworkable. It says that you have to include in the measure itself the amount that will be required to meet the provisions of the proposed law or amendment if it's enacted. Okay, who determines that? This has to come at the pre-prospective petition stage. because it has to be in the measure itself. It has to be in the language of the proposed measure. This is before you go out and collect your 1,000 signatures even. Okay, who decides what the impact is? Do you need to then convene some sort of a fiscal impact statement committee for every prospective petition? Well, that would be, you know, under the new law, under HB 2082, maybe 30, 40, 50 in every election cycle. You know, so although if you don't do that, then there's no basis for saying whether how much money is required to meet the requirements of the statutes if it's enacted. For example, when we were drafting Measure 47, what became Measure 47, campaign finance reform, limits on political contributions, we couldn't tell how much it would cost the state to implement or whether it would save money. Eventually, a fiscal impact committee determined or stated that it would cost about $1 million in the first year and less than $100,000 in each subsequent year. We had no way to know that. So if you don't know what the impact is, you cannot fulfill the requirements of this. There are other bills up that have more to do with fiscal impact committee operations, and I would like to also testify about those. But I think this bill, this is just unworkable, and it would be nice to have the subject matter of a hearing available before the hearing takes place. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you. So we're going to close our hearing on HGR 28, and we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 3431. And we'll have a short statement, and at the same time, if Representative Thatcher and whoever you want to bring wants to come up while he's doing that, that'd be great.
Chair Roebling, members of the committee, House Bill 3431 requires the Secretary of State or County Clerk to send a list of invalid signatures on state initiative, referendum, or recall petitions to chief petitioners. It allows persons whose signature is determined to be invalid to contact the Secretary of State or County Clerk within 30 days after the deadline for filing the petition to verify the signature. It exempts public safety officers from disclosure of their name, home address, and home telephone number on certain initiative, referendum, or recall petitions, declares an emergency, effective on passage.
Thank you for being here, and we look forward to hearing your testimony.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the record, State Representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. House Bill 3431, is, I believe, an important piece of legislation designed to enhance integrity of our initiative petition system, which most of us in the state are pretty proud of. House Bill 3431 makes one simple change to the current process of checking signatures on initiative petitions. It establishes a way to validate signatures once they've been rejected in the initial round of screening. The heart of the bill actually exists on page 2, section 1, subsection 7. After signatures are turned in to be counted and through the sampling process in place, some of them may be determined to be invalid. And then election officials would send a list of the bad signatures to the chief petitioner. The chief petitioner would then notify, if they chose to, the voters whose signatures were considered invalid for whatever reason. All this would happen within 30, then that voter would return to the state elections division, or actually to the county in this case, to verify their signature. And this happens within a 30-day window of the original deadline for turning in signatures. Now, I should say that we did ask Legislative Council to add a couple of other provisions in the bill, but they were left out. And one would be to set a 15-day deadline for elections officials to actually notify the chief petitioner by certified mail with a list of the invalid signatures. And two, this is important, make sure this provision only applies in those situations where rejected signatures could place the petition in a potential, you know, it would make or break the initiative. In other words, I understand there's going to be a work group formed to deal with this concept or the concept in this bill and other concepts having to do with initiative petitions. And so I remain open to modifying this proposal and I'm happy to bring back any amendments as necessary. But I do want to place a little bit of background on the issue and say up front that the subject matter of the ballot title or the ballot measure initiative petition is not the subject of discussion today. It's just the matter of process. In 2007, there was an effort underway to refer a law that was adopted by the legislature to a statewide ballot. Organizers collected signatures and turned them in by the deadline, and they needed just over 55,000, I believe, of signatures in order to put this issue on the ballot. Through the random sampling process, which, by the way, is in administrative rules, not a statute, around 8% of the signatures sampled came back invalid. So extrapolating that number out, the referendum failed to meet the signature requirement by a mere 100 signatures. Some of the voters who found out that their signature had been rejected tried to rectify that with their county clerk's office to see if they could prove, in fact, that it was their legal signature and do whatever it took to get it, you know, recognized. In most cases, they were told there was no process to review rejected signatures. This problem leads to a special memo sent out to the county clerks from state elections officials, and that memo is included in your packet, I hope you got, and it read in part, verbal statements and or affidavits from alleged signers are not allowed by statute or rule. There is no part of the process that calls for that, and as I'm sure you realize, we would not include a new step in this contentious process without legislative authorization. Bottom line, there is no due process for petition signers whose signatures have been rejected. I agree. Therefore, this bill is meant to fix that. The Secretary of State also issued a special directive last year talking about verifying signatures on petitions with voter registration records. And the directive said, county and state elections officials are not trained as forensic document examiners, nor as signature verification experts, and thus are not expected to make expert judgments as to whether two signatures represent the same person. Well, it seems a little contradictory to me, but on the one hand, the state's saying they have enough skill to reject signatures, but on the other hand, they would not have the skill or expertise to decide which signatures to toss back in. So there's a couple of things to consider. Under Oregon law, Oregon Constitution, actually, Article 4, Section 1, there's placed a deadline. The state has 30 days to complete the signature verification process. In fact, in 2000, in I think it was the year 2000, voters changed the Oregon Constitution to extend that time frame. It was actually 15 days before, to 30 days now. That measure was referred to the ballot by the legislature, and the legislative argument in support of this particular move listed in the voters' pamphlet. This, it said, the extra time will allow the county clerks to respond to the unexpected issues that sometimes arise in the verification process and to ensure the utmost integrity in the process while still meeting the constitutional timeline. So, even though most of the county clerk's approach said there was no way they could review these signatures, one county clerk actually did reinstate a signature that had previously been listed as invalid. So I think there might be a gray area out there and a need for legislative guidance. When the county clerks have to verify a signature on a ballot and it doesn't match up with voter registration records, by law, they send out a letter to the elector giving them 10 days to resolve the issue so that the ballot can still be counted. In one county, we were told that they also will go through the efforts of calling the elector on the phone to let them know that there's a problem. However, petitioner signers don't get that same level of consideration and aren't legally entitled to get those same checks as those who sign a ballot. Given all the attention to the initiative process, the many varied subjects I'm sure you've talked about over the past few weeks, I would argue that signatures on these petition sheets are just as important to our particular system here in Oregon and deserve the same level of checks and balances. You may hear today about how this particular case I'm referring to was challenged in the courts and went all the way to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit held that the state's random sampling process was okay. And you may also hear someone from the Elections Division say there just isn't enough time to notify signers when their signature gets rejected so that they would be able to contest that finding. And I need to point out, I'm arguing, that we're not expecting the state to contact these voters. This process would be left to the chief petitioners. And so that would help expedite the process. In the case that I'm referring to last year, the Elections Division finished the signature verification process in 12 days. Remember, they have 30, so they still had 18 days to do any follow-up work. Even though the court sided with the state, they left open the idea of improving the process here in Oregon, making it more clear, and that's what we're seeking with House Bill 3431. Many of the voters who signed the petitions that were challenged felt disenfranchised and felt like they were responsible for disenfranchising others. My staff contacted several of these people, and they're still quite upset about it. Today you'll hear from a couple of folks who have been out collecting signatures over the years, and in your packet you might see an email in there somewhere from one of the people who had her signature tossed out and had no way to recover. She wrote in part, "I was unable to check or have my signature verified, and it was very frustrating. I felt responsible for all the other signatures on the page," she says, "that were not counted because somebody decided mine was not valid. We were supposed to have a voice, and I feel like mine was taken away with no recourse." This bill makes it another small change, sort of unrelated to this, but it kind of closes a gap for law enforcement officers to check a box on the petition sheet requesting that their name, address, and phone numbers be redacted and not available as a public record as they can with all the other records. So, and that's all I have to say. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for this witness?
Representative Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not necessarily a question for the representative, but a question for the chair. We're going to hear from the Secretary of State's office on this bill.
We are.
I'll hold my question until that time.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm trying to look at, there were some people who signed up last time that have not signed up this time, so I just want to make sure if anybody's here. Jim Ludwig, and I think, Craig, did Jim? You testified, right? That's what I was thinking. That was Jim, wasn't it? But Craig Meyer, and you're not on the new list, but you are on this list, so come on up. And Dan Meeks, you can come on up too.
I have two items I'd like to distribute, or have distributed to you. One contains the quote from the Elections Division Director that Representative Thatcher read. It consists of just two paragraphs, and she read the second.
Be sure and, for the record, your name.
Craig Myers.
Thanks.
Thank you. And you'll see the two paragraphs that he transmitted to all of the county clerks in the state. And the two paragraphs contradict each other. The first paragraph suggests that they have the authority, which in fact they would seem to have based on the law that that Representative Thatcher was citing. The second paragraph seems to contradict the first paragraph completely. This is extremely important because I was present in eight instances where voters from Marion County and Jackson County were disenfranchised face-to-face with either the county clerk or and or the county clerk's staff. They had presented their driver's licenses. They had presented a copy of the petition that they'd signed and pointed to their signature on that petition and said, "This is me." And in some cases, in one in particular, an elderly gentleman said, "You know, the voter registration card that I turned in was turned in decades ago, and I've had a stroke since then, and my handwriting has changed entirely, And, of course, he wasn't compelled to re-register. He was being sent his voter form, you know, in every general election, just like normal. No one questioned that signature when he mailed it back. But on a petition, all of a sudden there's a big issue. So he came in, along with myself and other people, including attorneys, and we said, look, here's his driver's license. Here's his signature on the petition that he signed, and here's an affidavit, and here's a new voter registration with a matching signature that you can have, you know, for your permanent records. None of those things were sufficient in either Marion or Josephine counties, and perhaps other counties as well. I'm just citing you the examples that I was personally present at. And in both cases, I interviewed the county clerk in the presence of, in the case of Jackson County, the news media on film, and was told, based on the strength of what the Secretary of State's office had emailed, that the county clerks lacked the authority to make those changes. So regardless of what the second paragraph of that email says, It seems that it was intended to provide shelter for those who didn't want a particular measure adopted, to be able to say, under no circumstances and with the introduction of no sort of evidence will we enfranchise these voters. Now, that sort of thing does not go down well with the voters of Oregon, regardless of your political persuasion, and yet that was the position that was taken. It's a bad reflection on us as a state to have that kind of intractable position taken when, in fact, our Constitution was only just, or the law was only just amended to allow for the additional, for an entire 30 days, an additional 15 days in which to get this process done. And there was still time within that 30-day window when these voters arrived to make their request known. Now the clerks had not notified those people. A team working with the chief petitioners had notified them. In spite of all that, the case was made in district court and in the Ninth Circuit that it would be too much of an imposition, too much trouble for the state of Oregon to treat its petition signers with the same respect that it treats all of its ballot signers. These are the same individuals, the same registered voters. So I'd also like to introduce the affidavit that I signed for the district court hearing, just for added to provide added insight into what these individual disenfranchised voters endured. I'll have to say.
Thank you very much. We'll wait. Dan, go ahead.
My name is Dan Meek. I'm an attorney. I have represented several groups that have put measures or attempted to put measures on the ballot since 1978. This committee has heard testimony on a variety of bills about how we need confidence and people need confidence in the initiative process. I would say that confidence is rightfully severely undermined when actually provable, valid voter signatures are rejected, and those voters are provided with no method to vouch for the validity of their own signatures. And even when they do vouch for the validity of their own signatures, as you've heard, that their testimony is absolutely rejected by the folks in charge, the county clerks and the Secretary of State. You may hear that this would be too cumbersome to do. One suggestion is that you could apply this process only when the non-matching signatures make a difference. In my experience in the initiative process over 30 years, I can remember two instances of statewide measures where it came down to a question of whether some of the signatures were matching or not. So it might happen once a decade. So this is not going to impose, if you did that, it would impose almost zero administrative burden if you only have to implement it once a decade. And it might require at that point contacting statewide, you know, because we only do sampling statewide, that might involve contacting as many as maybe 100 voters. So I think contacting 100 voters once every 10 years is a small price to pay. However, I think that this process would work better if it were aligned with the vote-by-mail process. and because it would give more credibility to the process, and when voters are contacted, they would be contacted by a county clerk or the Secretary of State's office, and not by the proponents of the measure. We treated it like vote by mail. In vote by mail, if there is a non-match of a voter signature, the clerk has to notify that voter. I think it's within one day or 1 or 2 days. And I think you have to notify them at least by mail, if not certified mail. And as we hear, some clerks actually phone the voters. The voter then typically does, by rule, have 10 days to respond. One appropriate response is simply to send in a new voter registration card, which then the signature on the new card matches the signature on the voter envelope, then the vote is validated. And that would, of course, cover the process that we just heard about, where many people sign their voter registration cards 10, 20, or 30 years ago, and signatures do change over time. I do think that there needs to be as there is in vote by mail, a deadline for the clerks to notify these rejected voters, and there needs to be a period of time, such as 10 days, for the rejected voter in order to cure the problem, for example, by sending in a new voter registration card. At an earlier hearing in this committee, the Secretary of State was referring to this bill and said, well, if the count on a measure is close, then maybe we should verify all the signatures instead of verifying a sample. Well, unless you have this corrective mechanism for actually counting actual valid voter signatures, verifying more of the signatures is not a remedy. It just means disenfranchising more voters by subjecting more voters to the same process, which results in signatures being rejected on subjective grounds by folks who are not, as the Secretary of State has said, who are not forensic experts. So since we probably don't want to require all clerks and all of their personnel making these decisions to be forensic experts, very simple process, follow the vote-by-mail process when it comes to signatures which are rejected for non-match on measures, and maybe limit that to instances where it makes a difference. And I think that would be an incredibly small administrative burden and would completely protect voters who sign petitions. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both. Wayne Brady and Barry Pack.
Chairman Roblin and members of the committee, my name is Wayne Brady. I'm a resident of Salem, and I feel that the previous testimony covers a lot of what I was going to cover, but I do feel that putting that 15-day limit to notify the signers is a necessary addition to the bill. And I do feel that people's confidence in the process is shaken when events happen like was described before, where people couldn't even verify that was their signature. And I've found that my signature wanders around. Sometimes they say it's okay, sometimes they don't. So I think that is a serious problem. The other thing is I might disagree with Dan Meek on the process. I think this takes the burden off of the Secretary of State or County Clerk, and if that's going to be an issue, maybe this is a way to get more acceptance of the idea.
Thank you. Mr. Pack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. We have some questions, some comments, some concerns, some suggestions to offer, and I want to start by saying that we recognize that this is a very difficult issue. It can be an emotional issue for people whose signatures have been rejected. It's also an issue that has a lot of complications around it in looking for alternatives. I think it was interesting to listen to Representative Thatcher speak about the bill and about some of the ideas that she had originally intended that were not actually in the printed bill, because they do address some of our questions or concerns, and I would say that we think that there might be some further clarification necessary in the bill if the committee moves forward with it. House Bill 3431, again, appears to provide electors with a cure if their signature is invalidated on an initiative petition. The bill doesn't say what happens, though, with that cure. It says that a voter can come in to their county clerk or the state elections division and verify their signature. It doesn't direct us about what happens then. Our assumption is that means that it goes back into the pool of signatures that would potentially qualify an initiative. So operating under that assumption, one of our concerns is that if you provide an opportunity for a cure to an invalidated signature, you probably ought to also provide an opportunity for challenge to validated signatures. And I liken this to jury selection, where the defense counsel and the prosecutor are both given peremptory challenges in sitting jurors. And you wouldn't have due process if you only allowed one of those attorneys to strike a potential sitting juror. You need to allow both. And in fact, as has been mentioned in prior testimony, a lot of this did end up in the courts and in litigation in the Lemons v. Bradbury case, which Judge Mossman decided. And I would like to quote just a brief section of that decision where he wrote that the verification process is already weighted in favor of accepting questionable signatures, in part because only rejected signatures are subject to more than one level of review by county elections officials. Providing notice and allowing individuals to contest a determination that a signature did not match would further skew the process in favor of accepting invalid signatures, as there would be no corresponding notice to those whose signatures were erroneously deemed to match. So here Judge Mossman agreed that if you are providing a cure, you need to provide a challenge. And he went on in the opinion to observe that during the trial, a handwriting expert, a forensic handwriting analyst, reviewed a sampling of the signatures that were both rejected and accepted in that case and found that that handwriting expert would have found more instances where the expert would have concluded that a validated signature should not have been validated than found an invalidated signature should have been validated. So if you're following me, there were more signatures that the handwriting expert felt shouldn't have been accepted than there were that were thrown out. And so the judge noted that is further reasoning why you would want to have both. So if you follow this logic that I'm presenting, that you want to have a challenge and a cure, and if you follow the assumption that if an elector is allowed to come in and verify their signature and that it goes back into the pool of signatures that would go to qualify, it does throw a wrench into the statistical sampling method that we use to verify signatures. It would essentially make it so complicated that it wouldn't work. And therefore, we would want to move into full verification of all signatures, either with the counties or, as Representative Garrard, who sits on the General Government Subcommittee, knows, we do have a policy option package in that would bring all the signature verification in-house in the Secretary of State's office. I would like to mention that after the Lemons v. Bradbury decision came down, we did send out some clarifying requirements on the match, no match requirement. I'm missing my word today, I apologize, to try and provide greater consistency across all the counties. If we move to full verification, that's obviously an expensive and time-consuming process based on the number of petitions that are on any given ballot. In 2000, we had 21 initiative petitions to verify. And as has been mentioned, we are constitutionally obligated to do that within 30 days. If we move to full verification of all initiatives, we would really suggest that we would need to change those timelines, and that would require a constitutional amendment. So having said all of that, let me get to a potential point of agreement on this, which is that Secretary Brown has already begun some conversations with members, two members on our general subcommittee from either party, that it might make sense to look at full verification in very limited situations, in those circumstances where the margin of qualification is small enough that potentially some of these invalidated signatures, rightly or wrongly invalidated signatures, would make a difference. And I guess we would equate that to the automatic recount statutes in any other election. If it's within a percentage point one way on either side, either qualifying or disqualifying, we could look at full verification. That would be a way to contain the costs. It would be a way to contain the time constraints, assuming, you know, one possible problem with that is if a particular signature gathering firm is collecting signatures on a number of petitions at the same time and they're getting the same voters, we might end up with petitions where you're seeing the same margins. Now that, you know, that may or may not pan out to be true. It's a question that we would want to consider. So I think that that may be a way to address this situation that might be a little more workable than the broader concept as before you. We would suggest that we have some time to work on this, whether it's this session or that we come back in a future session with a proposal that's ironed out that can be worked on. I did want to also comment on one other provision in the bill that hasn't been discussed to date yet, which is the requirement that our petition sheets have a checkoff box where a public safety officer could check the box stating they're a public safety officer and would like their name, home address, and telephone number to be kept confidential and not a public record. As this committee is well aware, those petition sheets do become public record when they get turned into us. ORS 181.610 defines a public safety officer to include corrections officers, youth correction officers, emergency medical dispatchers, parole and probation officers, police officers, certified reserve officers, telecommunicators, and fire service professionals. It's a pretty broad list, and I think we would have some questions about whether or not there is an assumption that we would need to verify that the person who checked off their box saying they meet one of those categories actually is one of those public safety officers. There's certainly a potential for some loophole in public records laws if we don't, and we're not sure quite how that would work if we were supposed to do that, and of course the costs. And then we would just have to have some way to redact that information when we get a public records request and people want copies of petition sheets. We'd have to either temporarily block those out so that we can maintain the original record but not make that information public. And I'm happy to answer questions.
Questions? Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the question I had was answered as the testimony was being given and pertained to the number of errors discovered or assumed errors that were discovered by the professional handwriting expert that had not been caught by the department when they went through it. So I think we run as great or a risk of missing some as we do of making some mistakes in the other process. And short of some very expensive procedures, I don't know how we eliminate the possibility of mistakes, unfortunate that they are.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Garrard.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. And I want to praise Barry and the Secretary of State's office because I know they're taking this extremely seriously and trying to find alternatives. And once again, government is trying to make a very simple process much more complicated than it is, than just signing. But as far as the voters are concerned, this issue needs to be addressed now. No one's going to sign a petition if they think it isn't going to count. Why would you do that? So I just want to emphasize to the Secretary of State's office that I believe we need to address this problem and convince the voters that when they sign something, they're going to have a pretty good chance that that signature will stand up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions for these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
And And that ends the testimony on House Bill 3431. So we're going to close the hearing on 3431. And we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2845. And we'll have a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2845 directs the Secretary of State to add to the caption of the ballot title to certain state initiative measures a phrase regarding the financial impact designated by the Financial Estimate Committee. It requires the Financial Estimate Committee to submit to the Secretary of State one of five specific phrases set forth in House Bill 2845 that most accurately reflects the fiscal impact of the measure. It directs the Secretary of State to add the submitted phrase as part of the caption of the ballot title and voter pamphlet and on the ballot. It exempts that phrase from the 15-word caption limitation. It adds conforming changes to existing statutory procedures for preparing and filing fiscal estimates and for challenging whether those procedures were followed. Under existing law, which is ORS 250.125, the Financial Estimate Committee prepares estimates of financial impact, but is not required to summarize that impact by selecting one of a limited number of possible phrases that the committee determines most accurately reflects the financial fiscal impact of the measure.
Thank you. And with that, let's have Dan Meek, Cappy Eaton, and Andy Miller. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Galizio and Senator Morris. Thank you. I missed when you came in. And they didn't sign up, but I had it here. I was getting ahead to my list as opposed to the people who were already on my other list. So thank you for...
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8, Albany, Corrales area. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you again. I will not belabor the type of data that I had discussed with you previously with respect to the fiscal impacts. Without question, I think even those that are on both sides of initiative reform would recognize the profound and very, very significant fiscal impacts that initiatives have had on the state's budget. This bill originated within the concept of the Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring and Reform and Restructuring Committee, or task force, that was probably one of the more successful task force efforts in the history of the state. We looked at local revenue systems, we looked at the state's revenue systems, and we brought forward some very specific recommendations. This is one of those recommendations. The council that we had, advisors, tax accountants, attorneys, economists that advised the task force, looked at these issues and brought forth this recommendation that we, and it was called in the report, it was called a balanced budget concept. And the intent is, again, not to create barriers for access, but to create a more thoughtful, informed electorate. And that's what this bill is an attempt to do, particularly putting it up in the consciousness, the greatest consciousness of the voter in looking at the ballot title, and to have that information to make a more informed decision with respect to measures that may have very significant impacts without funding. I'll turn to my good colleague to discuss specifically the Dash 1 amendments and the details of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Larry Galizio, House District 35, also known as the Warm-Up Act for Dan Meek. And before I get into the bill, I did have a solution for Representative Harker, who was talking about Brazil and college, and he could send his son to community college for 2 years and then graduate at Willamette, and he could also go to Brazil.
What?
So just wanted to put that out there for
their kids.
Yeah. So anyway, you probably are so tired of hearing about the initiative system, but thank you for all your hard work, Mr. Chair, colleagues. he probably would just want to say, just go and do a work group and get it over with. So try to explain a little bit of the thought behind this and the dash one amendment. I'm hoping that you have a dash one amendment.
Let me do that, okay. That one.
And I think the key word in this attempt to provide more information for voters is context or contextualizing the proposed ballot measure or the ballot measure that's in front of people, just providing a little bit of context. Hopefully all of us decide issues based on context, in other words, understanding that we have to fund public safety, health, human services, and education. So this would have, we already have a financial impact statement currently. All the research would tell you that the ballot title is absolutely significant. It's, as somebody said, the coin of the realm. If you have a favorable ballot title or the information contained in the ballot title is very significant, it's very important. So although we have a fiscal impact statement or a financial impact statement, it's not necessarily up there with the ballot title. So the idea behind this one is right up there with the ballot title, you would have this more information and context. And specifically, it would deal with the source of funds. So perhaps you can call this bill the Show Me the Source of the Money bill. It would provide the following information, and it would this would be done by the Financial Impact Committee that already works on the fiscal impact. So they would look at the measure, and then as it says on the dash one amendment, there would be one of four statements on the ballot title. It would have the ballot title, and then it would say either A, the measure does not provide a plan for funding, or B, measure provides a plan for partial funding, or C, measure provides a plan for full funding, or D, measure has no fiscal impact. And that would be right up there with the ballot title statement. So an example of that would be, let's say we're talking about Measure 61 from 2008 creates mandatory minimum prison sentences for certain theft, identity theft, forgery, drug, and burglary crimes. Measure does not provide a plan for funding. So people who have thought a lot more about the initiative system and the impacts of different changes talked to us and said, well, wouldn't it be easy for somebody to just say, we're going to get the funding from the source of the funding is the general fund, and just leave it at that. So the dash one amendment, the last paragraph, letter C, small subsection C, says you couldn't simply say, we're going to get it from the general fund. You would have to be specific in terms of perhaps which programs that money would come from. I think both of us recognize that, number one, this is not going to perfect or solve all of the problems or issues. It's an attempt to provide more information for voters, to contextualize some of the decision-making, and maybe urge them to go a little deeper. In other words, if they see it has partial funding, perhaps it will motivate people to then look and say, well, I wonder where that funding is, and it would, and hopefully that would be identified by the proponent of the initiative, but perhaps not. So that's the idea. It's, again, providing voters with a little bit more information, hopefully some context, and I think we're amenable to looking at this further as people come up with different permutations as to what how people might kind of game the system, which is always a concern. But that's the idea. And with that, I'll end.
Any questions, Representative Berger?
Yeah. It occurs to me that conceivably you could have a measure that wouldn't fit into any of those categories. Let's imagine somebody like Mr. Meek came along and passed a petition that would say the state no longer can or will give step increases to any employee going forward forever. Well, that might mean that the fiscal impact for the state would be quite positive. And I don't see that in here. Is it possible?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think I caught the gist of your statement. If you have an initiative that reduces expenses, what accommodation would be made in the ballot title?
Exactly.
And I'm not sure we thought of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think that's a great point. The major concern was about those that tend to do that, but if, I mean, I'm certainly amenable if there was something. I think, again, the research shows that it's the ballot title that's really key in that information up there, so I think that's a great point.
I guess I'm thinking a little, excuse me, Mr. Chair, outside the box here. We in here tend to think of all of these things in the negative sense that how much is it going to cost us, how are we going to deal with it in our budget balancing thing. But outside of here, people don't necessarily think like that. And conceivably, there could be initiatives that would have a beneficial, that wouldn't fit into these boxes. And so if you're serious about this proposal, you might think about the other side of the coin, which is this measure would have a beneficial fiscal impact on the bottom line of the state of Oregon or something to that effect. Because it could happen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I think it's an excellent point because the initiative could very well reduce expenses, and that would be a category that we could add in a dash two.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either of you, does this bill, would it require that initiatives that are forwarded to the voters, measures, would it require that they not just identify in theory where the money comes from, what program is reduced or eliminated to pay for this one, but would the language to reduce or eliminate that program in the budget be included in the measure and therefore have the force of law when it passes? Or is this a theoretical, you know, I think we ought to do this new program and scour the general uses of general fund and you're going to be able to find something that you would be able to say, well, and we'll just get rid of that. But that's just in this summary financial impact statement, but not written into the actual initiative itself and therefore have the force of law.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the idea behind this is it would not require initiative petitioners really to do anything. It would require, though, when the financial impact statement was made, they would look at the wording of the initiative and then make a determination. So it would be up to the initiative petitioner as it is in the status quo to make a decision about
how they'll say that what should be eliminated to fund this program or what should be raised or
represented. So is that correct? His final one was that. What was your follow-up question?
Oh, it wasn't really a follow-up. I think we were having a little dialogue here.
I just wanted to make sure the answer was there. Okay. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an intriguing idea. I personally think it is something of a half step toward HJR 28 that we heard earlier, but HJR 28 is not something we can enact. This is something we can enact in this building. I do wonder, though, whether these categories are sufficient to make the delineation that would be helpful. For example, Measure 5 that put on the state the burden to make up the reduction in local school districts' revenues ultimately created a cost to the state general fund in the neighborhood of $4 billion a biennium over time, because we shifted from 20% of local revenues being coming from the state to now close to 80%. And you might have a ballot measure that would require a different way to print ballots that might cost $500,000 a biennium. If neither of them had a funding source, they would have the exact same line here. And while it's technically accurate, I'd be nervous that it would convey the same level of imbalance to the voter. alternatively, if Measure 5 had instead of no source of funding for the state, had created that $4 billion obligation but had generated $1 million worth of revenue and was then identified as partially funded. I presume you've thought through these implications, and I wonder if you can give me a little comfort in how we might address them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan. Yeah, and it's hard to come up with a short list that covers the waterfront.
Yeah.
Possibly a solution might be that in the amendment -1, line 3, that the Financial Estimate Committee shall submit to the Secretary of State one of the following phrases, including but not limited to, and then instruct the committee to the best accurate definition of the fiscal impact, because you're right, Measure 5 was a kind of a disconnect.
Right.
It reduced property taxes, so it had its fiscal impact to the voter was to reduce the cost to them. But on the other hand, it shifted funding in a very profound way without identifying where those funds would come from. So it might be that we could craft language that it includes but not limited to, and then address the task to the Fiscal Impact Committee to best craft the language, again, succinct, that would go in that ballot title to describe the impacts of the measure.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, I think, first an observation, I think we're illustrating here one of the problems or the concerns about the initiative system right now, because we're looking at trying to simplify usually extraordinarily complex topics with a ballot title, and the research shows this is how, this doesn't mean that people don't, you know, come and make decent decisions. This is also a problem with those of us in this this building that don't read the bills. So shame on us if we don't read the bills. But it's extraordinarily difficult in a short period, in few words, to convey the complexity. So we're just trying to have a flag that says, oh, by the way, in broad outlines, and it's imperfect. It is imperfect. But if we can get people to at least, it's almost some like a teaser. In other words, what does that mean, partial funding? And you hope that then they read further, but...
Not a follow-up, but just a comment. And it's that both raising the voters' curiosity and just giving them a little information to think about that is appealing to me about this bill. Because, again, I think it helps voters have or seek out more information, which I think is more likely to lead them to a thoughtful deliberation on the ballot measures that they're voting on, and I think that's only to the good.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you very much. Maybe this is the last time I'm here before you on this.
We hope not. Issue. We hope we enjoy having your company.
Well, thank you very much.
So Dan and Cappy, we'll do it two at a time because there's four.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kappa Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And as you know, the League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The impact on the general fund from unfunded initiative mandates over the past two decades has been so severe that the state has not been able to support essential programs in education, human services, and public safety. This is severely impacting Oregon's progress. Senator Morris has referred you to the Task Force on Revenue Restructuring, which did recommend, after a lot of discussion in that task force, that the legislature address this problem. House Bill 2845 seeks it in a simple way, and the League of Women Voters supports the effort. The fiscal statement that is required for all appropriate ballot measures and currently is provided through the explanatory statement apparently is not sufficiently informing voters. Most people read the ballot title, as you heard people talk about already, but they do not necessarily realize that the funding is not provided for the new programs. The lack of understanding that now costs the general fund almost 50% of the revenue in programs that were put in place through the initiative process with no funding provided. These mandated programs include the building and maintaining of prisons because of sentencing guidelines and the reduction of local property taxes in schools, as been mentioned for ballot measure 5. With no additional revenue sources, the state support pie must be cut in smaller pieces for all programs, even as the state's population grows. House Bill 2845 would indicate the fiscal impact of any proposed program in the ballot title, along with either stating an available funding source or that no funding source is provided. Voters that can then make an informed decision to support or oppose any proposal that costs money. This is a reasonable and responsible change in the initiative process, and we urge the committee to give it serious consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Meek.
Dan Meek. I have represented groups attempting to put and sometimes successfully putting measures on the ballot since 1978. This bill is a good idea, and I would offer some friendly amendments and also some comments, if I may, 5 comments. First is, this doesn't distinguish between, as Representative Berger pointed out, positive and negative fiscal impacts. If you have a positive fiscal impact, what would this ballot title say? It would say, fiscal impact with no identified source of funding. Thanks. Second, it draws attention to and emphasizes cost of a measure, even if it is minor or even infinitesimal. By drawing attention, I mean, it takes the information that is now presented in the voter's pamphlet, it's there, it's in the fiscal impact statement that's below the ballot title, and moves it right up into the caption, which is what I would say probably 98% of the people read, and I don't know what percentage base their vote on it, but it would greatly elevate and greatly emphasize the fiscal impact, even if a measure has an infinitesimal fiscal impact and really has nothing to do with spending money. My favorite example, of course, Measure 47 of 2006, campaign finance reform. The Fiscal Impact Committee stated that it would have a first-year impact of $1,012,020 and less than $100,000 in years thereafter. Now, if you put that, if you say that's a fiscal impact, as pointed out by Representative Nolan, that doesn't distinguish it. There's no distinction between that and something that decimates the state budget or requires a lot of spending. If I think the voter should be given actually more useful information, let's put this in the context of the state budget. So instead of saying this is going to cost $1 million in the first year, it would say this is going to cost 4/1000ths of 1%. of the state budget in the first year. Put it into a context so that not everything is treated as a large amount of money when it isn't. You'll note that all of the statements are just fiscal impact, very vague. I think all of these statements should say what the fiscal impact is and not just say fiscal impact. Fifth, how does this apply if the measure is a constitutional amendment? Currently, you do have to have a fiscal impact statement on constitutional amendments, but if you specify a funding source in a constitutional amendment, then it runs up against the two amendments provision of Article 17 and may not be allowed on the ballot in the first place. So I think if you want to apply this also to constitutional amendments, then you need a joint resolution in order to do it. Once again, I, of course, had no opportunity to see the Dash 1 amendments until a few minutes before this hearing, but I would say they are even less workable than the original. First of all, there's no threshold at all for applying the provision in the Dash 1 amendments, even if it costs 1 cent. It has to go through this process. I would say let's on this and on the original, let's put a reasonable threshold on this. How about 1% of the state budget? That'd be $250 million in a biennium, I think, something like that. So that if you're less than that, then let's not emphasize the fiscal impact and lump measures that spend very little along with measures that spend a lot of money and say that they're all essentially raise the same level of concern. In addition, the Dash 1 amendments have the same problem that I described earlier about the other joint resolution, in that it requires the Secretary of State to print in the voter's pamphlet phrases such as measure does not provide a plan for funding, or measure provides a plan for partial funding, or measure provides a plan for full funding. Well, who knows what full funding is when you're drafting the measure? Because there's been no fiscal impact committee. So this would also require the fiscal impact committee to convene to look at every prospective, not only every prospective petition, but would have to be a pre-prospective petition process to submit pre-prospective petitions to a fiscal impact committee to decide the fiscal impact. And then in drafting the measure, you'd have to, have a plan for providing full funding. Otherwise, you would always not have a plan for full funding because you don't know how much funding is required, unless you get to make it up yourself, in which case I think the whole, it's a pointless process. If in subsection, the last subsection in the Dash 1 amendments, it states that if it identifies a general source, has to identify the specific programs or services that would be eliminated or reduced. Well, then would it also be appropriate if the measure saves the state money that it could specify how the saved money would be spent? Then ballot measure proponents could simply pick out the most popular possible use of state money and put that in their measure. Even though it might save an infinitesimal amount of money and dedicate a very small amount of money to this new purpose, that new purpose would then suddenly receive great prominence and help the measure to pass, even if the measure didn't deserve to pass on its merits. And finally, about the concern that everyone would just, ballot measure proponents would just say, well, this will come out of the general fund, so you don't allow it to come out of the general fund. If I were drafting a measure, I would say this measure would be fully funded by increasing fines on criminal offenses. That's fully funded, and I think that would probably increase the popularity of the measure. So I think this needs a lot of work. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of these witnesses? Seeing none, thanks, both of you. Georgette Brown and Andy Miller.
For the record, I'm Georgette Brown. I'm representing the Oregon County Clerks Association. And in theory, the clerks are not against more information to the voters. I mean, we always like to have more information go to the voters and do our best to do that. However, on this, I didn't give him. Sorry. Did you pass that? We have found that there is a very strong potential of a fiscal impact to the counties. And you'll see that by the handout that you're going to be given. In November 2008, there were 12 state measures on the ballot. In 2006, 10 state measures. In 2004, 8 state measures. In 2002, 12 state measures. In the November 2000, there were 26 state measures on the ballot. And we have found that this caption, this statement phrase that would have to be added to the caption would also be in bold because it would be by the caption on the ballot. And it could conceivably cause not only a 17-inch ballot, but maybe two ballots, depending on how many measures you had, if that had to be on the ballot. In recent years, we've gone to just putting the caption and the question on the ballot because there just hasn't been enough room for the whole ballot title. The whole ballot title includes the caption, the question, and the explanatory statement. So what I would suggest would be putting it in the explanatory statement if you want to add more information on the fiscal. Together with the ballot, we always send a flyer that gives the full measure and the full question with the caption and the title and the explanatory statement. I'm sure you all have seen that with your ballot. And if it were put there, you could put more information about it, as was suggested by other people, and yet it would not add to the length of the already very lengthy ballot that we usually have at the general election.
Mr. Chair, Andy Miller, Oregon Business Association. Thank you very much for letting me talk to you today. I have prepared comments, which you have, but I want to address one thing that has come up several times, and that is in paragraph 3, where I say too often measures produce unintended consequences. And there's been some question about what unintended consequences are. It may have been the intention of the petitioner, is my contention, but it may not be what the voter thought it was. Does the voter understand the consequences? So we're not trying to get at content here and block people's right to the initiative system. We really want people, as Cap Eaton put it, to make the most educated vote they can. It is imperative that voters have complete information about the financial impact of the initiatives and referenda they are to vote on. Too often, measures produce unintended consequences, such as higher than anticipated cost to taxpayers. In addition to making state budgeting more difficult, Oregon's initiative and referendum system has unintentionally weakened the financial status of the state, resulting in lower bond ratings and increased borrowing costs. This is the primary reason that we are interested in the initiative process. That our members, the bond rating is problematic, and as you know, we've had to make use of bonding quite a bit more than we would like recently. So I think that's what's driving us to really look at this in terms of the fiscal impact in those statements. I do agree with, listen to this, Dan Meek, on many things that he suggested through the course of these deliberations. He has some very good ideas about how to make things better. And also, Georgette's idea has some merit. But since that committee that Frank alluded to, Senator Morse alluded to, came up with this as a part of a whole package of straightening out our revenue system. I think we really need to take that into consideration when we study this measure and try to make it work, try work with it so that we can address the concerns that people have and honor those folks that put in all that time on the Revenue Restructuring Task Force. We do support the concept of cautionary ballot title language that accurately reflects the funding or fiscal impact of the measure. The language we support is in the Dash 1 amendments. I'm sure we will see Dash 2s and Dash 3s, or at least I hope we do. While there is no certainty that these warnings would change the results of an election, there is certainty that the voters would have a more accurate picture of the consequences of the measure, and I urge you to consider this as part of a comprehensive package. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you both.
Thank you.
And that ends the testimony for House Bill 2845. Gonna make sure I got everybody. including people from the previous day. Yep. So we're going to close the hearing on 2845, and we will open the hearing on House Bill 28. Is he here yet? We have only one person that wanted to testify in 2820. He's not here yet. It's a representative. So I think we'll move on to... did you sign up, Dan? Okay. We'll go then. 2820. Thanks. So, Dan, you are the only one, and hopefully you'll be here so that Mr. Representative Witt can get here. Oh, and Andy's on there, too. Okay, very good. So we've got a few people, and Cappy as well.
They're coming out of the liver.
That's right. Well, the other day, they didn't all sign up on this, so that's good. 2820.
I am the same Dan Meek who's testified previously. This bill is not a bad idea. It basically sends the prospective petition to a legislative committee. The legislative committee would have to be both in during the session and out of session because most prospective petitions are filed when the legislature is now out of session. So I guess that would be called some sort of an interim committee. So that would have to be how this would work. It then imposes what is basically an 8-week delay in the process. I don't understand exactly the rationale for having a report due from the committee within 10 days and then giving the committee 35 days to conduct a hearing. That seems to be that you would do the hearing before the report and not vice versa. And I think that this is not a bad idea. The eight-week delay, of course, initiative proponents would not appreciate, but perhaps the trade-off could be inserting a deadline on judicial review of ballot titles. That's where we've got the 6 to 7 to 8 month potential built-in delay and uncertainty. So if, let's say, put with this a deadline that the court or the panel of retired judges, as in the next bill we'll discuss, has 30 days from the final filing of briefs to make its decision, I think this would be a fine process to add to that deadline.
For the record, Andy Miller, Oregon Business Association, thank you once more. I hadn't intended to testify on this bill, but I really do like it so much that I checked with my legislative sponsors on our other stuff. We call this indirect light as sort of a way to remember what we're talking about. And this bill has the advantage in that it doesn't have to be a referral, which the indirect initiative does. And it accomplishes some of the same things, I think. It forces the legislature to confront difficult issues. And this is something that the voters really benefit from, because right now an initiative could qualify and then lose, and so the legislature never has to deal with it. And this gives the legislature that opportunity. I think it helps to restore your credibility, which is one of the problems I know that you've wrestled with. I have a few concerns about the bill, specifically in Section 3, Sub 6. It says the Initiative Petition Review Committee may conduct public hearings on the petition. I think that needs to be a shall, because otherwise they would pick and choose, and you wouldn't get a fair sampling necessarily. And then in the next subsection D, the chief petitioners of a state measure to be initiated may amend. That should stay may. So, in other words, they don't have to take the recommendations of the committee. So you've got a may that should stay and a may that I think needs to be a shall. Other than that, that's why I put down neutral, because there was a little problem with that. But I really think this is worth considering and in a package, and I agree again with Dan about the ballot title review process being so extended. And so that's something else we could look at. And I appreciate take any questions.
We'll go to Cappy first, and we'll have the whole panel.
For the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cappy Eaton, Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon.
The League has for many years been advocating for some kind of a review process. And unfortunately, over the decades, actually, that we've been trying to get some kind of review, whether it be by the Legislative Council, whether it be by the Attorney General, whether it be by a review citizen committee, whatever, somehow those bills have never been passed. There was a panel for a couple of election cycles, a panel of retired judges that was named by the former Secretary of State that did give advisory opinions on constitutional initiatives. But that's what they were, advisory, and for one session they were put into the voter's pamphlet. House Bill 2820 proposes a process for a limited review of initiatives with the ability of the chief petitioner to revise the petition if desired. There is no requirement for public hearings, only that they may be held. The League does not believe that House Bill 2820 is strong enough or helpful enough to citizens who really need to know what a proposed initiative will do. The timeline for the review process and the required report is very short. The League prefers the most definitive review proposed in HJR 17 with the required consideration of the initiatives in a longer timeline. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Mr. Meek, do you think if we had had this process in place, it would have benefited any of the initiatives that you've been involved in? Or could you give us an example of how you think it might have been helpful?
Representative Nolan, I think it could well have benefited some of the measures. I assume that the Initiative Petition Review Committee would have available to it the services of Legislative Council and perhaps Attorney Generals as well, and could well have improved the prospective measures that were submitted. I don't know exactly in what way, but I could imagine that they would be improved. The important difference, I think, between this bill and HJR 17 and HJR 17 and SJR 11 is that this allows the chief petitioners to amend the measure after receiving the feedback from the legislative structure. Those other resolutions require that the petitioners go out and collect all of the signatures and before the review begins, and at that point it's, you know, the chief petitioners obviously cannot amend the measure. All that they can do instead is ask the legislature to put on the ballot a similar measure, which they have no assurance would be done. Of course, since generally the reason folks are out using the initiative process is because the legislature is not doing what they want, the notion that the legislature would suddenly do what they want under those two resolutions, I think, is pretty slim. So this is a far more useful concept than it gets the sequence. It is a much more useful sequence.
Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you all. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Brad Witt, State Representative from House District 31, appearing before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2820. This bill would establish a joint initiative petition review committee as a committee of the legislature, the purpose of which would be to identify potential faults as well as strengths with prospective initiative petitions before they go out for signature. The bill provides for two means of doing that. First, The committee could review the bill, and within 10 days send any clarifications that it deemed appropriate in terms of either the purpose of the initiative petition or its effects. Or secondly, the committee within 35 days of being sent the prospective petition could hold public hearings to, in essence, publicly vet the initiative petition. Either way, following those two routes, the committee would issue a report and to the chief petitioners. Of course, this would be a public document and open to public scrutiny. The chief petitioners then would have an opportunity then, should they deem it appropriate to modify the prospective petition to do so. They would have 5 days to do so. And following that 5-day period, then the Attorney General would issue a ballot title. The Joint Initiative Petition Review Committee would be a bicameral, bipartisan committee. The Senate would put up three Republicans and three Democrats, and the House would do the same. With that, it's a very straightforward proposal. It would presumably save the state considerable effort in getting the proposed petition right before it goes out for a signature. And would also provide an opportunity for the public to become familiarized with both the subject matter as well as any potential strengths or weaknesses that would be surfaced through the report, through the hearings and subsequent report processes. Thank you very much.
Questions?
The only comment, and you were unable to be here when the first group of people all spoke in favor of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, at the risk of torpedoing anything that people spoke in favor of, I will silence my testimony.
But the one question that came up was the idea of, instead of may have a public hearing, will have a public hearing came up, just because the idea was that it's a good way to get people to know more about the issue, and changing it from may to will in that particular place, and then leaving it shall when it comes to may when it comes to whether they can change it or not. They liked that part. So is that something that in your mind makes a big difference in this bill, or and that was just one person's comment.
Mr. Chairman, frankly, personally, I would prefer that route and try to make this process as uncumbersome as possible, but given the fact that there appears at least to have been public testimony in support of what I would have preferred to do, I would be all in favor of that.
And the only other question, it is April 1st, and I was wondering why it wasn't 6 House members and 3 Senate members. There are twice as many of us.
Well, and precisely. This ought to be weighted representation, Mr. Chairman, with that.
Any
I
other?
I thought you were making a comment on quality, not just numbers.
It's both. I mean, I think you get more quality when you have a few more of us. So, anyway, thank you very much for your testimony. And there was a lot of appreciation for the ideas that come to this bill. So I'm sorry you didn't get to hear some of that, but it was very nice.
I'll review the tape, Mr. Chairman.
Thank
you. Thank
you very much. So with that, is there anyone else who wishes to speak to this bill that didn't get a chance to? I'll ask that on this one. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2820, and we will open. We're getting pretty close here. A public hearing on 2942. we'll have a short explanation. And as they're doing that, we could have, except Rep. Garrett is not here. So Joe Bessler and Dave Cannon and Bruce Miller can come up if they would like.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2942 transfers the responsibility for reviewing ballot titles from the Supreme Court to a review panel composed of five retired judges. It establishes a criteria for retired judges qualified to serve on the panel, prohibits more than two panel members to be members of the same political party, and requires the two largest political parties in the state to be equally represented on the panel. Declares an emergency effective on passage. ORS 250.085 currently provides that persons dissatisfied with a ballot title may petition the Supreme Court seeking a different title.
And I noticed that they switched to Justin Black. So with that, Mr. Cannon, I guess, if you'd like to go first.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm one of those repeat offenders testifying on more than one initiative bill. I'm representing the City Club of Portland's study committee on the initiative referendum and referral that spent over 2 years here.
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. David Cannon from Portland. I at the hearing on Monday, I gave some background as to the process that this committee used and the amount of time that it took before we came to our conclusions and recommendations. I won't repeat that because it's already in the record. And I have just brief comments on this bill of Representative Garrett's. House Bill 2942 implements the City Club report's recommendation number 6 to assign retired senior judges under Plan B of the judicial retirement system to assume the current responsibility performed by the Supreme Court justices to review challenges to ballot measure titles. Our committee concluded that repeated challenges to ballot titles for the purpose of gaining political advantage frequently, whether pro or con, are requiring an unacceptable use of public resources. When the state's highest court is diverted from its already full docket of civil and criminal cases to hear large numbers of ballot title challenges, there were 90 of them in 2004, for example. The cost is hard to calculate, but it is significant when you consider the amount of time required of both the justices and their staff, not to mention to possibly contributing to delays in resolving the normal business of the court. Now, it has been argued that with the advent of House Bill 2082 that we won't see so many initiatives get to this point because it requires 1,000 signatures. However, we've only had one cycle with that experience, and we did indeed have fewer initiatives to reach this part of the process. But based on past history, I would be reluctant to conclude that the organizations and businesses that are very involved in initiatives in Oregon won't find a very efficient way to come up with 1,000 signatures whenever they have an initiative. So I would not be confident that we're going to see a real long-term diminution in the number of measures and therefore the number of challenges. The use of the retired senior judges who have chosen to perform voluntary service as part of their retirement plan was certainly not something that our committee dreamt up. It was advocated by several former justices of the Supreme Court whom we heard from, as well as other judges and some other individuals close to the initiative process from all parts of the political spectrum. One former senior staff attorney from the Judicial Department also endorsed the proposal to us. We tested the idea with many witnesses who came before our committee, even if they hadn't heard of it, and very few expressed any reservations about it. In most people's minds, I think, the task of adjudicating ballot title language, although it's important, is not necessarily one that requires the expertise and authority of our state's very highest judicial officials. Now, the City Club report did not go into any particular mechanism in our recommendation, but I would note that this bill, as currently drafted, does contain some provisions designed to assure that the panel of judges is bipartisan in makeup, and it addresses some other details of implementation. These are beyond the scope of my testimony, and we just trust that the working perhaps with the Judicial Department, that the House and Senate will work out adequate measures to implement this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office of the State Court Administrator. Thank you for taking time to listen to my comments this afternoon. Representative Garrett has generously allowed us to weigh in with some suggestions on this bill to help improve the process that's contemplated here. And he asked that I go through some of those suggestions with you to give you a sense of where we think the bill may ultimately end up as it goes through amendment process. The bill is currently drafted, has the petitions filed with the Secretary of State. Under current law, petitions are filed with the Supreme Court, and we would suggest that it's best to keep that process in place for a couple of reasons. Number one, that allows the process to flow as it has in the past through the Supreme Court with the benefit of the Oregon the appellate rules that are in place that deal with briefing, time of briefing, length of briefing, and oral argument. And then that way that sort of process wouldn't have to be set up on the Secretary of State side. In addition to that, especially when you're using active Plan B judges, there's the possibility of a separation of powers issue if you have active judges working in the executive branch, and this would avoid that problem. The next broad area that we were thinking of was in the terms of referring the challenges to the panel. We had a discussion with Representative Garrett about whether it would be better for that to be mandatory or permissive. We believe it would be better to be permissive for a couple of reasons. One is we're dealing with a relatively small pool of judges, and they need to be willing to serve. And if for some reason we could not assemble the proper size pool, having the permissive referral would allow the Supreme Court to take those cases if the panel doesn't work out. The Chief Justice also felt, although he couldn't articulate how this, the scenario, he felt there may be occasions when a case would come that the Supreme Court would prefer to take themselves, and this would allow them to do that. In general, dealing with pro tem judges and Plan B judges is an administrative function that is handled by the Chief Justice as the head administrator of the court system. The way the bill is constructed now, the Supreme Court as a body would handle that administrative function. We think it'd probably be best to use the system that we currently have in place. The Supreme Court is a collegial body, and that works great for deciding lawsuits. It doesn't work so well when you're trying to administer. The last point we'd like to make on how we would like to see the bill end up eventually is there are a series of requirements in the bill regarding party affiliation, having held previous party office, having held previous political office. My sense is that those requirements were simply dropped into the bill from some older concepts involving redistricting. In general, always judges are nonpartisan. Elected and appointed judges are nonpartisan officials, and they are well accustomed to being impartial in the matters before them. We think it would be better not to have those particular constraints in there because it will make it easier to put together the panel that you need to do this work. There are a couple other things that I'd like to alert you to regarding the use of Plan B judges. The way this is constructed, we're talking really about two groups of judges, the ones who are still active under Plan B and the ones who have served their service under Plan B. A Plan B judge serves 35 days a year for 5 years at no salary. That judge is entitled to reimbursement for travel and costs. We generally have about 25 judges that fall into that category. Of course, they're at various stages of their service. To the extent that we can use those judges, then there won't be a cost for their salary, although there would be for S&S, staff, office, computer, and travel and reimbursement. to the extent that we can't use those judges because they are not willing or are unable to serve, then we would have to go to those who have completed their service, and we would use them as pro tem judges, and they would be reimbursed as a pro tem judge is now. The last point I'd like to make on the pro tem, on using the Plan B judges, that is a valuable resource for the circuit courts, and you will be removing that resource, at least some of those judges, from use in the circuit court. Some minor things as we think about this. I don't know how this will work because I'm not sure how many people we have and how long they will have to serve. You could run into problems with the inactive or with the ones who have completed their service, running into problems with their PERS time if they put in too many hours. But my suspicion is we can get around those issues. So thank you for your time this afternoon, and we hope to have some amendments on this later on for you to consider.
Any questions? No, I want to thank you very much for those insightful comments, because I think sometimes we look at an idea, we think it's pretty good, but it takes someone with the different perspective to come. So I appreciate that, and I think Mr. Representative Garrett probably also appreciates that a lot. So thank you.
Great. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Justin Black, and I'm from the Oregon Education Association. We represent about 48,000 education employees all across the education spectrum. We are active participants in the initiative process, both gathering signatures and opposing measures. Our members look at the initiative process as a very active one, and we view this as a good release valve for the Supreme Court. The panel, as Representative Garrett has set up in the bill, seems to be a fair one. This seems to be a fair process, and I will keep myself short based on the fact that it's almost 5 o'clock. So I will say that we think it's a great idea. We think that that it's an unbiased panel that they've set up, and I'll leave it at that.
Questions for this panel? Representative Berger.
No.
Oh, okay.
Just moving this away.
Okay. Thank you very much. Two days ago on Monday, there were some other people who signed up who did not today, so I will give them an opportunity if they would like to speak on House Bill 2942. Is that the one we're on? And Cappy Eaton, Dan Meek, and Richard Bottier had signed up if they would like to. And I see two of them. Do anybody interested in? Nope.
My name is Dan Meek. I would not support this bill as currently written. First of all, I think the need for it has been significantly mitigated, if not eliminated, by House Bill 2082 of 2007, which has reduced the number of prospective petitions filed in the same period for the two election cycles by 85%. There have only been 14 of them filed in the past year and 3 months. So the volume of ballot title challenges has probably also gone down by 85%, although I haven't checked that specifically. Second, this does add a layer of insulation from accountability to voters. That is, as tenuous as that might be for Supreme Court justices. If the justices do take positions, including positions on ballot titles that voters don't like, they do have accountability to voters every 6 years. Their opinions are published, their opinions are signed, however, appointments to this committee will not be nearly as transparent, and it just removes a level of accountability, because it takes the decision out of the hands, the decisions on ballot titles out of the hands of folks who are responsible to voters at the ballot box every 6 years. You'll note that in this bill that there is no deadline for the review panel to complete its work. The language is the same as it is in the current statute pertaining to the Supreme Court about doing it in an orderly, about conducting it expeditiously to ensure orderly and timely circulation of the petition. That's already in the statute, and that doesn't prevent the process from taking so many months that it has the effect of negating or nullifying the opportunity to collect signatures on some measures. If this were to go forward, I would certainly recommend a deadline, 30 days from the time briefs are filed, I think would be a good deadline. There's also no provision in this bill for publishing the decisions of the review panel. Supreme Court decisions are published easily accessible on the Internet, and they establish precedents that are then quoted in subsequent decisions. So there needs to be a provision for publishing these decisions in some way, preferably, as the same way Supreme Court decisions are published. Now, it was either 4 or 6 years ago, I and others made a proposal to the legislature to use the Plan B panel of judges for ballot title review. That, of course, was before House Bill 2082 reduced the volume of ballot of potential prospective petitions for review by 85%. In addition, it was along with a proposal that what the panel would do is conduct baseball arbitration. That is, each side and even others who are, third parties, would submit their proposed ballot titles to the panel along with argument, and the panel would have could choose one of them, but not draft its own and not sort of pick apart any of them. That, I think, would encourage everyone in the process to submit the most accurate and reasonable ballot titles possible, because only if you submit one that is reasonable and accurate do you have a chance of having yours selected. And if you say anything unreasonable in your ballot title, it's likely to be rejected and you'll end up with one you don't like. I would prefer that process also to be a blind process. That is, the ballot titles and arguments for them would be submitted to the panel blind, without any identification of who is proposing the ballot title or who's making the argument. But as just simply shifting the existing process from the Supreme Court to a panel of judges, I wouldn't support that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to close our public hearing on 2942. And before we go, the one comment I would like, and I appreciated the comment from Mr. Meek at the beginning of the session, we will work at trying to get amendments. The problem is that we have a lot of amendments flowing, and it's difficult at all times to have them ahead of time. But we'll see about making sure that when we get them ahead of time, we'll get them on the Internet. Yes, Representative Berger.
Yes, in the spirit of the day, Mr. Chair, I would submit that amendments be sent to Mr. Meek's desk over there on the side of the room.
But I just want to put it on the record, I really do appreciate the hard work that our Legislative Council office is doing. We are putting a lot of pressure on them with our new timelines this session and last, and they are under extreme pressure to get things moved fairly quickly, and we move these bills along with some regard for them, but there's also the deadlines that we have to get the bills done, so it creates a lot of work for everybody, and I agree that that also means that people who come and testify, it's difficult for them to know at times because of those. And at the same time, we do have a process that allows people to bring to the committee as they come amendments that we didn't know were there, and that's going to be impossible to stop. But I do appreciate the idea of making sure as much as possible we have an open process, and always appreciate constructive criticism when we're doing things. So from that, I will... Well, that's right. We will move HJR 23 over to Friday, April 3rd, and we actually caught up quite a few, so we're pretty close there, just looking at the time. And with that, it gets us to have people come back more often. We appreciate the diligent attendance that people have made in coming to these, and with that, we'll adjourn our meeting of the Rules Committee.
Okay.